Good morning. Good morning. Alrighty. We're ready to continue our study of Hosea. We spent yesterday laying groundwork, and we're going to spend quite a bit of time today, possibly even all of today, as crazy as that may sound, doing the same, and be prepared to get into the text in a very real way tomorrow. I would like to start out with a brief review of some of the things we talked about yesterday. One of the things we pointed out was how often the New Testament writers, apostles, and prophets quoted the minor prophets. Even Jesus himself quoted Hosea chapter 6, verse 6 a couple of times to the Pharisees. We noted also that the minor prophets are very relevant today. They've always been relevant, but they're relevant today in a way that maybe they haven't been before in this country. And what is the reason for that? That is, if you agreed with what I said yesterday. Yes, we live in a nation now where Christianity has rivals. I was asking the kids downstairs yesterday, I said, how many of you know at school or know someone who is a Muslim? Hands went up. How many of you know someone who adheres at least to some extent or shows interest in the teachings of Buddha? Hands went up. Now, those of you who are above the age of 50, put yourself in that class, not that one existed necessarily, but if there had been a class like that and the teacher had asked your age group that question, how many hands would have gone up? Just a few? You lived on the West Coast, though, right?
Southern California.
Okay.
I could tell you more.
Yeah. Oh, we already know. That's why we live here. No. It's everywhere, though. It's everywhere and in a very real way now. You go canvassing in neighborhoods, even here in the buckle of the Bible Belt, and you're going to meet people. Well, we're not actually in the buckle. We're a little off of it. But you're going to meet people who've just got all kinds of ideas. I don't buy into Jesus. I'm studying with a man right now. He's somewhat open-minded to the possibility that Jesus may well be the Son of God in the sense that he's deity, but he's very open to a lot of other ideas, too. And from that standpoint, the minor prophets have a very relevant message for us because that's the very type of world the Jews lived in when those prophets were working among them. We yesterday went through a progression of prophecy. We put four categories up on the board that all the prophets leading up to the minor prophets and including them could be put into. The first of them I called the pre-classical category, and among several in that category was Samuel. What happened in Samuel's lifetime? How did God's using of prophecy among the children of Israel change in Samuel's lifetime?
They rejected God as king.
All right. They rejected their God as king, and they went, of course, to a fleshly monarchy. Samuel's there during that change to stabilize things. Prophetically speaking, did anything change in Samuel's lifetime? What had prophecy been like during Samuel's, when he was a boy? What does it say? Yes, the word of God was scarce. There was not widespread revelation. By the time Samuel's gone, that is much less true than it had been. We see him presiding over this group of prophets in the 19th chapter. We see another group in chapter 10. So we start seeing these sons of the prophets or something like them. And then we looked at Elijah and Elisha. And you remember I drew up that wave up on the board, and you've got these three crests. One thing I didn't do, which I wish I had, is when you look at that, you've got Moses and Joshua, Elijah and Elisha, Jesus and the apostles, and at the top of each crest, Moses, Elijah, and Jesus. Where have we seen those three together? Mount of Transfiguration. Here was the law. Here was the prophets, but this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Hear him. But we do have these three periods of power, I might say. It's possible there were other miracles going on in between times, but God does reveal these three times as special occasions. The minor prophets, we divided them up into three categories, three ages. What were those ages?
Pre-classical, exilic.
Okay, so we pre-classical, classical, exilic, and post-exilic. Now that's all of prophecy. The minor prophets themselves are divided up into three ages. Assyrian, Babylonian, and Persian, of course. And why are they called minor prophets? They're linked. You know, that may be very obvious to those of us who are upstairs. I brought up the question downstairs, and a young man raised his hand and goes, well, maybe it has something to do with their message, or maybe it's less important or not so significant. That's the very sort of thing we want to dispel. It has nothing to do with the name at all. They're just shorter. The order of the minor prophets that we have, it's not the same that was in the Septuagint that the Jews were using in the first century. Who ordered our Old Testament? What was the name of that group of scribes? The Masoretes. They were responsible for the Masoretic text. And notice again that they organized them. Assyrian age, Babylonian age, Persian age, and even within those ages, they're chronologically organized, at least in the last two. Okay, we got into the first chapter of Hosea, the first verse, just a little bit. And we noted the meaning of Hosea's name. And what is that? Salvation. And although Hosea is going to talk a little bit about coming salvation, for the most part, what's his prophecy about? It's not about salvation. It's about coming destruction. His name serves as the antithesis of what the children of Israel have to look forward to. And a couple of significant figures in the Bible who shared his name, the last king of the northern kingdom of Israel, and also who? Joshua. His name originally was Hosea. And Ellie approached me after class to share with me some information about the Hebrew, and I had mentioned him, I might ask him to say something this morning. If it's all right with him, I'm going to put that off, only because I'd like to do a little more study before we dwell on that much, but I do want to hit it before our study's over. Hosea, whose name means salvation, he's mentioned as the son of Beeri. We don't know who that is. But we have a time period in which Hosea prophesied. Hosea 1:1. He prophesied in the reigns of these five kings, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. And we spent a little bit of time talking about the difficulties we have with biblical chronology. That yes, the Bible does give us reliable time periods during which the kings reigned, and yet there are things at work that we may not be fully aware of. What is one factor that plays into us possibly misunderstanding those numbers at times? Co-regencies. Yes, we had the example of Nebuchadnezzar and Nabopolassar overlapping 2 years. We know about that one. But we don't know how many years what two kings overlapped, for example. David and Solomon. David was clearly alive for a period of time. Charles pointed out he thought probably a good long while, and that may well be right. We don't know how much. So we start at the beginning of Saul, we end at the end of Solomon. You'd say, well, it ought to be 120 years. Well, it's not going to be. And so immediately, right out of the gate, we just don't know exactly where we are. One thing I didn't mention yesterday, which I do want to mention now. When Saul and Jonathan died in battle, who became the recognized king of Israel? Okay, Ishbosheth, remember? Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, was recognized as king by most of Israel still. How long did he reign? Anybody remember? It was 2 years. It was 2 years. 2 Samuel chapter 2, verse 10. And is David king while Ishbosheth is king? Yes. Not of most of Israel, but he is king in Judah. He's reigning in Hebron. So you have there not a co-regency, but rival kings. They're both king. Now, David's the rightful one, but they're both king at that period of time. Now, we happen to know how long Ishbosheth was king, which removes any problems. But we may not always know that. If you join with me in Hosea chapter 5, and I may be getting a little ahead of myself, or we may be getting a little ahead of ourselves, but I want you to notice the language, and we're going to see this more than once. Let's step back to verse 4. Hosea chapter 5, verse 4. They do not direct their deeds toward turning to their God, for the spirit of harlotry is in their midst, and they do not know the Lord. The pride of Israel testifies to his face. Therefore, Israel and Ephraim stumble in what? And what's the pronoun there? Their iniquity. Now, we learn to regard Ephraim and Israel as synonyms for the same body of people much of the time. And that may well be right. But notice here, there does seem to be a distinction. Israel and Ephraim, their iniquity. Chapter 7, verse 1, we see it again. When I would have healed Israel, God says, when I would have healed Israel, then the iniquity of Ephraim was uncovered and the wickedness of Samaria, for they have committed fraud. A thief comes in, a band of robbers takes spoil outside. I don't want to say this with absolute certainty, but there is a possibility that in the northern kingdom, there at its end, which would make perfect sense, when you've got a kingdom weakening and a kind of a political vacuum because there's not a strong ruler like we're going to see Jeroboam was, that you're going to have rival rulers. Pekah, we know, reigned 20 years. That's those sheets I gave you yesterday. If you'll look on the kings of Israel, it's the top sheet. I just happen to have experience with Thiel's chronology. He's this second column here. But if you go down to Pekahiah, or pardon me, Menahem, he's the third from the bottom, fourth from the bottom. Notice Thiel has his reign beginning in 752 B.C. Does everybody see that? And then you go to Pekahiah. He begins in 742 B.C. Menahem reigns 10 years. Pekahiah reigns 2. And then where does he have Pekah's reign beginning? Way back up where Menahem was. That Pekah, in his estimation, and you know he's not gospel, but he makes some interesting points, that Pekah may well have been reigning as king in a part of Israel while Menahem and Pekahiah were up in Samaria, and it wasn't until Pekah murdered Pekahiah that he began to reign in Samaria. But for a time, you had rival kingdoms. That, again, is something that is going to play into chronology, if in fact it's there. So that's the reason for the difficulty. But we noted that if we took right at the if we took Thiel's chronology and we started right at the end of Jeroboam the second and right at the beginning of Hezekiah, that would make Hosea prophesying for 37 years, but he likely prophesied for much more. He could have gotten married at 20, prophesied 60 years, and died at an age of 80, and that wouldn't be unusual at all. So a lot of the man's life spent in declaring God's word. Are there any comments or questions on that material? Wade's got something. Did we have a microphone?
Were you going to mention chapter 8, verse 4 in connection with these various kings that may have been ruling at the same time?
I wasn't. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, in chapter 8, verse 4, there seems to be an allusion to that very thing. They set up kings, but not by me. They made princes, but I did not acknowledge them. There are a lot of coup d'etats.
Yes.
Occurring at this time, a lot of rivalries and factions that seem to be represented by Pekah and Pekahiah.
Okay.
And that may be what he's referring to in chapter 8, verse 4.
All right, thank you. Good comment. Anything else? Okay. Let's turn our attention now to those political circumstances that were at work when Hosea is prophesying. Who was Jeroboam II's father? There's Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who was the first king of Israel. But this Jeroboam we're talking about now that's mentioned in Hosea verse 1, chapter 1, verse 1, what's his father's name?
Joash.
Now, prior to Joash, but beginning in the days of Jehu, there was a systematic shrinking of the northern kingdom. In 2 Kings chapter 8, verse 12, remember Elisha says to Hazael, who is going to become king of Syria, I know what you're going to do to Israel. You're going to do all these terrible things. And Hazael acts as if that was impossible for him. But when he comes to the kingship, he does just that. 2 Kings 10, 32 and 33, we read, in those days, in the days of Jehu, the Lord began to cut off parts of Israel. And Hazael conquered in all the territory of Israel. In the 13th chapter, verse 22, Hazael, king of Assyria, oppressed Israel all the days of Jehoahaz. So during the reign of Jehu and Jehoahaz, Hazael is having his way with Israel. And the kingdom is shrinking and shrinking until, as we noted yesterday, 2 Kings 13, 25. And let's look at that passage just one more time. 2 Kings chapter 13, verse 25. Pardon me. 2 Kings 13, is it 22? 32? Pardon me. We're in early in the 13th chapter. Verses 3 through 7 is what I wanted to look at. Sorry about that. Verse 7. 2 Kings 13, verse 7. For he, God, left of the army of Jehoahaz only 50 horsemen, 10 chariots, and 10,000 foot soldiers. For the king of Syria had destroyed them and made them like the dust at threshing. You have a kingdom now that is nothing. Nothing. They have basically no means really to defend themselves. They're being allowed to exist by their neighbors. They're dwindled to nothing. But that's before Jeroboam comes to power. Joash has three victories over Syria, just like Elisha said he would. And then his son Jeroboam comes to power and everything changes. And I think this is relevant to what we see in Hosea and in Amos. In the 14th chapter of 2 Kings, notice how the reign of Jeroboam is described. Starting in verse 23. 2 Kings 14:23. In the 15th year of Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah, Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, became king in Samaria. And he reigned 41 years. Now that's a long time in a kingdom that goes through kings like, goes through very fast. Here's a man who reigns 41 years. He did evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not depart from all the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who had made Israel sin. But notice what he did do, verse 25. He restored the territory of Israel from the entrance of Hamath to the sea of the Arabah, according to the word of the Lord God of Israel, which he had spoken through his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet who was from Gath-Hepher. For the Lord saw that the affliction of Israel was very bitter, and whether bond or free, there was no helper for Israel. Even as wicked as they were, God has compassion on them. And the Lord did not say that he would not blot out that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, not yet. But he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. So God makes a decision. A kingdom that is at the brink of disappearing, God makes a decision. Here is my people. This is not what I want for them. I'm going to deliver them through Jeroboam. And so, yes, a man who has a lot of ability probably and who's a gifted leader has God working through him. And it says in verse 25 again that Jeroboam restores, notice the word, he restores the territory of Israel from the entrance of Hamath to the Sea of the Arabah. Now go down to verse 28. Now the rest of the acts of Jeroboam and all that he did, his might, how he made war, and how he recaptured for Israel from Damascus and Hamath what had belonged to Judah, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? All right, now to understand these geographical references like you have in 25 and 28, let's just take a note of something. It says that he restored the territory of Israel, verse 25, from the entrance of Hamath. Now, Hamath is a city way north, up in Syria on the Orontes or Orontes River. This doesn't say he gets all the way up to Hamath, but to the entrance of Hamath. Numbers chapter 13, verse 21, just makes the passing statement that the entrance of Hamath is near Rehob. Now, based on the research I did, we're maybe not even entirely sure where Rehob is. I admittedly have not been satisfied with what I have found so far regarding where exactly this entrance of Hamath is. But we do know it marks the northern part, the northern extremity of the kingdom of Israel. And we know that because in 1 Chronicles 13, verse 5, during the reign of David, when the kingdom was at its almost maximum capacity. In 1 Chronicles 13:5, when David is gathering all Israel together, it says, to bring the Ark of the Covenant back into Jerusalem, we read, David gathered all Israel from Shihor in Egypt as far as the entrance of Hamath. From the southern extremity to the northern extremity, they all came to do this. Same thing's mentioned in 1 Kings 8:65, when Solomon's dedicating the temple. From the brook of Egypt to the entrance of Hamath. In other words, then, the northern kingdom, which had been shrinking and shrinking at the hands of Hazael, now through Jeroboam extends its borders all the way back up to where they'd been in the days of Solomon. Huge. That would be like the United States losing, I don't know, a third or half of its dominion, and then we have a man come to power, and we extend the borders all the way back. Now imagine how demoralizing that would be. The nation shrinks and shrinks and shrinks, and you just see the power dissipating, and one man comes to power, and we're back to where we were. What's that going to do to a nation? That kind of victory. They extended all the way to Hamath, and then it says all the way down to the Sea of the Arabah. That's the Salt Sea, the Dead Sea, Deuteronomy 3:17. Your King James says the Sea of the Plain. My Young's Literal says Sea of the Desert, but it's just referring to the Dead Sea. So from the Dead Sea all the way up to the entrance of Hamath, he's got this vast kingdom now. With that kind of military success, what's going to happen to a people? What are just some of the natural consequences? All right, we're going to get pretty proud. You know, I have to admit, I don't want to talk politics, but I certainly do get tired of hearing, it doesn't matter what party it is, talking about how great America is, how great America is. We are very blessed in this country. But I get tired of this. There's a pride in our country. And I believe patriotism can have its place. I have no problem with patriotism. I cry certain moments in our nation's events. I'm moved by them. I don't have a problem with patriotism in its place. But this arrogance that, you know, somehow by our own virtue or how we deserve what we have. What do you have that you did not receive from God? We've got a proud people here. What else just happens on a physical level? When a country's having lots of victories, they're getting more territory. There's therefore more trade. What's going to happen financially? There's going to be prosperity. Now, it's not going to trickle down to everybody, granted. But a lot of people are going to have a whole lot more money than their ancestors did, or maybe their parents did. A lot of luxury, a lot of arrogance. We won't be surprised then to see people manifest a lot of wickedness as well. Notice finally in verse 28, he recaptured for Israel from Damascus and Hamath what had belonged to Judah. Just reemphasizing, David had conquered Damascus, 2 Samuel 8. Solomon had controlled cities in Hamath, 2 Chronicles 8. He's got what they had. And it's happened through him. That's going to make for a pretty big head. And for the things we talked about among the people. Now, that's what's going on in the northern kingdom. What about the southern kingdom, Judah? Are they just shrinking and suffering? No. Concurrent with what Jeroboam II is doing in the north, Uzziah is down south, and Judah is experiencing an explosion of success as well. 2 Chronicles 26. Second Chronicles 26, starting in verse 6. Speaking of Uzziah. Now he went out and made war against the Philistines, and broke down the wall of Gath, the wall of Jabna, and the wall of Ashdod. And he built cities around Ashdod and among the Philistines. God helped him against the Philistines, against the Arabians who lived in Gur Baal, and against the Maonites. Also the Ammonites brought tribute to Uzziah. His fame spread as far as the entrance of Egypt, for he became exceedingly strong. And Uzziah built towers in Jerusalem at the corner gate, at the valley gate, and at the corner buttress of the wall. Then he fortified them. Also he built towers in the desert. He dug many wells, for he had much livestock, both in the lowlands and in the plains. Go down to verse 11. Moreover, Uzziah had an army of fighting men who went out to war by companies, according to the number on their roll, as prepared by Jael the scribe and Maaseiah the officer, under the hand of Hananiah, one of the king's captains. The total number of chief officers of the mighty men of valor was 2,600. And under their authority was an army of 307,500 that made war with mighty power to help the king against the enemy. Now, during Jehoahaz's reign, when Hazael had shrunk the kingdom down to the very bottom, how many foot soldiers did they have? Do you remember? 10,000. Now, here's an army with 307,000, in ancient terms, a sizable army. Verse 14, then Uzziah prepared for them, for the entire army, shields, spears, helmets, body armor, bows, and slings to cast stones. And he made devices in Jerusalem, invented by skillful men, to be on the towers and the corners, to shoot arrows and large stones. So his fame spread far and wide, for he was marvelously helped till he became strong. Notice the things we just saw there. In Uzziah's reign, the Philistines are subdued. They've been a problem, but not anymore. The Ammonites are now bringing tribute to the kingdom. That's an influx, significant. Fortified towers are being built in Jerusalem to fortify the capital city. Towers are being built out in the desert to guard the borders of the kingdom. And there's this war machine that's far in excess of what Israel had had. 307,500 in the army. They're fully equipped. They've got everything that modern man at the time had. And on top of that, verse 15, what has been invented? Siege engines, catapult-like things, ballista. In Israel now, they're now being used for the first time, at least on record here in the Bible. This is a tremendous success. And the same thing that's going to happen to the people in Israel is going to happen to the people in Judah. What did God say to the children of Israel? When you get into this land, and there's all this prosperity, vineyards you didn't plant, cisterns you didn't dig, you're going to have all this prosperity, and when you get it, what are you going to do? You're going to forget me. And granted, the northern kingdom, by and large, had already done it, but it was only going to be exacerbated now. We know the building trades flourished during this time. Let me point out just one thing. The city of Hazor in the northern kingdom, there's been a fair amount of excavation there. And you know when they do those excavations in the Holy Land, and Ellie would know a lot of this from firsthand experience, watching it and seeing it. You know, there have been people there so long that when a city is destroyed, they rebuild, destroy, rebuild. And so they look at the cities by strata. And stratum number 6 at Hazor, which is dated to Jeroboam II. One man wrote this about it. It gives evidence of a flourishing city. Especially noteworthy in this period were the Israelite houses. The workmanship of the builders was excellent. Amos talks about the palaces that they were living in. 3 times he mentions it. We're told in Amos 3:15 that they were building houses of what? Does anybody happen to remember? Ahab did it too. Houses of what? Ivory. Now, of course, not a whole house constructed solely of ivory, but houses with a lot of ivory in them. Houses where the walls and the ceilings would be embellished with it. You'd have plaques, panels of ivory. I don't have any idea how much money we're running into, but this is something the people are doing. This word for palaces has to do with high buildings, the sort of place you would expect a king to live in, people are living in. Now, is there anything wrong with wealth? No. Please don't walk away saying John's got to burn his saddle about people having money. It has nothing to do with that. But how people use their money does say something about them. And particularly in light of the religious circumstances, which we're going to talk about here in a moment, it says even more. While God's people were just leaving him further and further away, and coming destruction, it was pending, the prophets were saying it, here are people building their houses, paneling them like in the days of Haggai, making their own little piece of paradise, as one brother said, only to even knowing, or should have known, that it was going to be destroyed. The luxury was accompanied by excesses. We won't return there, but Amos chapter 6, verses 3 through 7 goes through some of that. You know destruction's coming, or at least you've been told, and you're laying around on your beds of ivory or couches of ivory and living it up, listening, singing idly to instruments. You just get this picture of people laying around and the palm leaves are fanning and just wasting away the hours because they have the money to do so. That's one thing I think is very interesting. You know, if you read Ezekiel 16, and it talks about Sodom and Gomorrah, Sodom, and it lists the sins of Sodom. When we think about Sodom, we think of homosexuality. But when you read Ezekiel 16, it does list their abominations, but it lists some other things. And among them is their abundance of idleness. Does a culture that is having to work itself to the bone just to get by, where men are having to get up before the sun, work all day, and then fall into bed collapsed from labor, and the women are doing their work too. Does a society like that have trouble with homosexuality? No. The cultures that have trouble with homosexuality are the cultures that are thriving financially. It buys you time. What are all these men in Sodom doing? It's nighttime. It's time for bed. And they're surrounding this house demanding that these men be brought out. They got too much time on their hands. And so also may have been the case in the northern kingdom. Greed and injustice flourished. I do want to point out one thing in Amos 5. Amos, again, being a contemporary of Hosea. Amos chapter 5, verses 12 and 13. We know the poor were being oppressed. The scales were being made out to be deceitful. They were making the ephah small and the shekel large, just scalping the people. And the people knew it, but they were powerless to find help. Amos chapter 5, verse 12. I know your manifold transgressions and your mighty sins, afflicting the just and taking bribes, diverting the poor from justice, where? At the gate. Now, what's significant about the gate? What happens at the gate? That's where the leaders are. That's where judgments are made. So here you are, the poor. You know this merchant over here has been dishonest with you. He's done it repeatedly. You're losing a lot of money. Your family's hurting for it. There's clear evidence that he is mistreating you. What do you want to do? You want justice. So you say, well, I'm going to go to the gate and I'm going to get justice. But could you get justice at the gate? Verse 13, therefore the prudent keeps silent at that time, for it is an evil time. The courts are in cahoots with the merchants. You go to the gate hoping to get justice and you might walk away with even less than you came. Imagine being in a society like that. We're not there. There's still justice in our country. As faulty as it may be much of the time, there's still justice. You can go to a court and have a hope that things will work out as they should. That hope's gone in Israel. The poor are abused, and the only thing they can do is keep quiet and put their trust in God. Any comments on that? Well, one more thing. I'd like to talk about the religious conditions now. We've been making reference to them, but let's talk about the idolatry in a little more specific detail that existed in the northern kingdom before we finally do get into the text of Hosea. We know that Israel had always had trouble with idolatry. We see it at Mount Sinai. We saw it in the wilderness. We see it in the days of the judges. But it's interesting to go back and at the beginning of the northern kingdom and see how it progressed through the history of the kingdom and leads us to the days of Hosea. What king of the northern kingdom has the dubious honor of having begun the northern kingdom's descent into idolatry? Jeroboam. How many times in Scripture we read the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat? Read 1 and 2 Kings, and it's over and over. 10 times altogether. This king did not do what was right in the sight of the Lord, but he continued in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. 2 times we read Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel sin. He was in a national place of authority. People do follow what the leader does, and he got him started down this road. Now, why did he do it? Political. Absolutely. Here you've got this new kingdom, pretty sizable kingdom. But this kingdom's always been attached to Judah down south, the city of Jerusalem. The nation has always been brought together by its religion, not just its heritage. And, of course, eventually the feast is going to roll along and everyone's going to want to go to Jerusalem, right? Well, you're never going to hold on to your kingdom with that. Over time, people's loyalty is going to start moving in the direction of the house of David. So Jeroboam got some advice, and he made the two calves. He puts one in Dan, he puts one in Bethel, in the north and the south, and says, here are your gods, O Israel. Go here, the ones who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. Politically speaking, was it a good move? Politically speaking, it was genius. It worked. If you take morality out of the picture, which you never really can, but if you do, on a pragmatic level, without God in the picture, this was genius. It worked. He does just what Justinian does in 533 AD. Pope, we're now going to regard you as rector ecclesiae. You're the Lord of the church. Let's get west and east together so I can consolidate my power. And Jeroboam's, let's keep everyone here so I can consolidate my power. But notice, I have to admit, I have always thought of what Jeroboam did. I've read those passages and I've always thought of it as the sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. But notice that's not how it's worded. The sins of Jeroboam. And I thought it might be an interesting study to list those here, to see where this begins. 2 Kings 12, let's start there. 2 Kings chapter 12, verses 28 and 29. That's not, it's 1 Kings, thank you. 1 Kings chapter 12, 28 and 29. Therefore the king asked advice, made two calves of gold, and said to the people, "It is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, which brought you up from the land of Egypt." And he set up one in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. Sin number one, he makes these two calves. And notice the language he uses. What does he say about these calves? Where have we heard that statement before? That almost that exact same statement was made by Aaron at the foot of Mount Sinai. Do you think there was anybody in the northern kingdom when Jeroboam said that they thought of Aaron? I've heard this before. I don't think this is a good thing. I think that's interesting. You know, at the end of 1 Kings 16, when we're learning about the days of Ahab, and remember what it says of Hiel of Bethel? He lost two of his sons building the city of Jericho. Now, there was a prophecy made by Joshua, and what had Joshua said? There's a man that's going to try to build Jericho, and he's going to lose his two sons doing it. Now, why are we told that Hiel did that when we're told about the days of Ahab? Because that tells us something about the society, right? Either Hiel didn't even know that Joshua had said it, in which case you've got no knowledge of the Word of God, or he knew and he didn't believe it. And I think we may have a similar situation here. Here are your gods. I know better than that. That's what Aaron said. You know what they got for it. Well, maybe they don't even know that Aaron said that. Or maybe they don't believe it. But this is where the sin begins. Why calves? Why are we building statues of calves? What was that, Tom? All right. There is a connection to Egypt, definitely. They had seen that worship in Egypt, and you said that's what they were accustomed to seeing.
Canaanites and Amorites, had calves represented in their pantheons.
Yes. Keith made the comment that the Canaanites and the Amorites all had calves in their pantheon. That is certainly true. The calf was related to what god? Anybody know? The bull god. Who is that? What was it over there? It's going to be Baal. Baal. Baal was the bull god. A bull represents fertility for obvious reasons. You bring him into the herd so that you can have reproduction. And Baal was the bull god. In fact, he's talked about like that in the writings of the time. This is what people would have been used to. And the idea of the calf is interesting. It's a little difficult for me to know if that's exactly what's going on here, but the calf, in at least some of the time, was not necessarily regarded as the god itself. But the calf was the pedestal on which the god stood. And that it could have been a rationalization at the time. Well, this isn't actually God, it's just his throne. But nevertheless, it was something they would buy into, they were accustomed to. Now notice verse 31 of chapter 12. 1 Kings 12, 31. What else does Jeroboam do? Yes, he builds shrines where? All right. Now, probably it's referring back to these two high places at Dan and Bethel. Let me ask a question. Now, of course, Baal worship is wrong. And having the calf and all that, even if it was connected with Jehovah, would be wrong. But often we read about high places in the Bible, and they have a negative connotation, and rightly so. But based upon what the Bible reveals to us, was it inherently wrong to worship God on a high place? No. And furthermore, was it wrong to sacrifice to God on a high place? No. I think this is interesting. You know, this puzzled me for a long time. God puts his name down in Jerusalem, or for a time it was at Shiloh, or maybe it was at Gibeon, and that's where the altar is, but people live a long way from there. and people are going to sin. They need to make sin offerings. There are other types of offerings. Do they have to travel all the way down there every single time? Wouldn't everybody be living in Jerusalem if that were the case? What were they supposed to do? Well, we know they could build their own altars if they followed certain parameters. Exodus chapter 20, verses 24 and 25. I won't turn there. But God says there, Exodus 20, verses 24 and 25, "In every place where I record my name, I will come to you, and I will bless you." And it there describes how an altar is to be made. It's to be made of earth or of stone. And if it was made of stone, what were you not supposed to do? You're not to cut it. You're not to use any tool on it. If you're going to make an altar, it needs to be made out of what I made, which is a very interesting thought in terms of our worship to God with the voice. Will we worship God with things we've created, or will we worship Him with what He created? I think there's a definite parallel there. Now, how would God record His name in a place? You can build an altar there, but it needs to be where I have recorded my name. How would God go about that? Well, Deuteronomy 27 gives us an example. And the point I want to make here is you could have an altar other than the one that was at the tabernacle. That's obvious. Exodus 20, you're going to have a description of the altar at the tabernacle seven chapters later. So you could have these concurrent altars, but you could only have them where God said you could have them. Deuteronomy 27, beginning in verse 4, here's what Moses commanded the elders of Israel and the people before they crossed into the promised land. "Therefore it shall be, when you have crossed over the Jordan, that on Mount Ebal you shall set up these stones, which I command you today, and you shall whitewash them with lime. And there you shall build an altar to the Lord your God, an altar of stones. You shall not use an iron tool on them," that's just what the law said. "You shall build with whole stones the altar of the Lord your God, and offer burnt offerings on it to the Lord your God. You shall offer peace offerings, and shall eat there, and rejoice before the Lord your God." You're going to have an altar, and where is it going to be? Mount Ebal. Very likely a high place, but you can have it there because I said so. This really helps me understand what, for example, does anybody remember where Solomon was when God came to him in the dream and asked him, told him, "Ask of me and I'll give it to you"? Where was Solomon at the time? He was at the high place of Gibeon. 1 Kings chapter 3, verse 4. He went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, for that was the great high place. Now, the tabernacle was there, yes, but it's a great high place. And I thought, what's going on there? Is God just overlooking this? No. Apparently, God had recorded His name there. This was all right, so long as God said so. Same thing in 1 Kings 18. Elijah meets the prophets of Baal where? Mount Carmel. They're up on a high place. And when Elijah lets the prophets of Baal try to get an answer from Baal and he doesn't answer, what does Elijah do? 1 Kings 18:30, he goes and he repairs the altar of the Lord. What's an altar of the Lord doing on Mount Carmel? God apparently recorded His name there. So it's just an interesting thought. It's been eye-opening for me to see that. God would, through command, make it known that a certain place could be sacrificed at. We see other examples of it in the case of Gideon in Judges 6 and in David in 2 Samuel 24. Remember when David had numbered the people and God was bringing the plague and the angel of the Lord stopped at the threshing floor of Araunah. Where do you put threshing floors? You put them on a high place. You don't put them in the valley. You can't get any wind there. You put a threshing floor up on a high place so the wind will carry away the chaff. And it's there that the angel of the Lord stops, and it's there that God tells him through Gad, I believe it is, go and build an altar on a high place again. But God said you could do it. All right, so it's not the high place that's the problem. It's that Jeroboam's chosen where the high place is. And, of course, he's doing these things there. Jeroboam sets up two calves. He builds these shrines that God has not mandated. And then he does something else. 2 Chronicles chapter 11, verse 14. Starting in verse 14. "For the Levites left their common lands and their possessions and came to Judah and Jerusalem, for Jeroboam and his sons had rejected them from serving as priests to the Lord. Then he appointed for himself priests for the high places, for the demons and the calf idols which he had made." And we'll address that demons here in just a moment. So he rejects the Levite priesthood establishes his own priesthood. Why doesn't Jeroboam just say, okay, if you're a Levite, you can, and you're son of Aaron, you can be a priest, but you can't be a priest of Jehovah as you have known him. You're going to have to do things my way. But if you'll do things my way, that's okay. He just rejects him totally out of hand. I'm not going to take any of you. Why does he do that? Yes. What's really happening here? It is a rebellion against God, but what is Jeroboam really creating? He's creating a whole new religion. What does Hebrews 9 say? With the changing of the priesthood, there must also of necessity be a change of the law. He's changing it altogether. He's making his own religion. He does mention, by the way, there, as you noted, that these priests would be for the demons. Does anyone in their translation have something other than demons or devils in that passage? Does it say he goats in yours? Okay, thank you, Carter. Yeah, the word in the Hebrew is this right here. And with Ellie in the audience, I'm getting a little sheepish about claiming to know anything about this. I don't know what that mark means, but that's how it's written in the lexicon. The word means shaggy, and as a noun, it's used with respect to a he-goat, a male goat. Does that word, when you think about goat and you look at that word, does that word remind you of anything? Sure. In classical mythology, the satyr was half man, half goat. What I think this may be referring to is simply not only was Jeroboam encouraging this, but he was also upholding the worship of goat deities as well. And that may have been up in the north. So he's encouraging all kinds of things, but none of them good. I guess one of the things, as I'm looking at all this, that really starts to jump out at me. Let's look at one more. He does one more thing.
John.
Yes, Mark.
Well, back in the 1 Kings 12, the priest that he picked was of the lowest people.
Okay.
So he didn't pick people who had any kind of prestige. He picked people who felt like they were always being left out.
Mark was pointing out that the King James renders that he appointed priests of the lowest people. My New King James says from every class of people. I don't know what the Hebrew is on that, but maybe lowest people just means the common people. That it wasn't necessarily that they're the dregs of society or anything, but just anybody. You know, hey, I'm an equal opportunity employer. You want to be a priest? Come on in, and I'll work it out for you. One more thing that he does, 1 Kings 12, 32 and 33. 1 Kings 12, 32 and 33. Jeroboam ordained a feast on the 15th day of the eighth month, like the feast that was in Judah, and offered sacrifices on the altar. So he did at Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he had made, and at Bethel he installed the priests of the high places which he had made. So he made offerings on the altar which he had made at Bethel on the 15th day of the eighth month, in the month, this phrase is so outstanding, in the month which he had devised in his own heart. This is what I want. Now, we've started a new feast, but it's very specific. It says it's going to be on the 15th day of the eighth month, and it's like the feast down at Jerusalem. What feast happened on the seventh month, the 15th day? Not the Passover. Tabernacles, the Feast of Tabernacles. He doesn't want them going down for that feast, so he's going to start his own feast. We've got a new feast. You got new gods, new feast, new priesthood. Now, one question I have, and I don't have an answer for it. Why does he make a feast to replace tabernacles as opposed to Passover or Pentecost? Changes their history, says Keith. That's an interesting thought. Because tabernacles, of course, mark their coming up out of Egypt. Okay. The Day of Atonement is near to that date. Okay.
That's what he's replacing.
It's not the Feast of Tabernacles that he's replacing?
Well, is that the Day of Atonement?
Those were separate entities. Yeah, that's the Sabbath month, so I guess there are three festivals, isn't it? The Feast of Trumpets, the Feast of Tabernacles, and the Day of Atonement. So yeah, maybe he's killing three birds with one stone. Let's choose the biggest one, the one they travel for, and by so doing, I can make sure they don't go to the other two also. That's an interesting thought. Did you have something, Steve? Gary, did you have something else?
Just going to say that's the one day a year that the high priest was in the most holy place.
Okay. Yeah, if you can keep him away from, okay. The 10th day of the 7th month is when the Day of Atonement is. Okay. And I think the trumpets would come before that. I'm kind of shooting from the top of my head, but I think there are three in that month. It was the 7th month, the Sabbath month, and it had three festivals. Oh, sorry. Okay. Dan's got a comment back here.
It seems to me that whenever you have something that like this is going way off, there's always something that is almost non-negotiable that you know if you try to change something, that the people won't buy it. And so Maybe the reason for that feast was the Day of Atonement was one of those things that was too close, too powerful, and if you messed with that, you wouldn't get your following.
Okay.
But this is a much easier thing to buy into.
Okay. Interesting thought. Was there any other comments? We've got a couple over here, Ray and Steve.
The lowest of the people, I took it that they selected the lowest of the people because no one else would do it. The Levites especially left the land, left their homes. Of course, they weren't given an inheritance with the rest of Israel, so it wouldn't be a problem that would be with the other people. They left and went to Judah. If you recall, when they worshiped the golden calf before, and they said, who's on the Lord's side?
Yes. Good point. And the Levites still were. That's right. Good. That's good.
Relating also to number three, the changing of the priesthood, it always appears in the modern person's mind that this thing is a sudden change. And in many ways, these things are, but they're not original. I mean, Solomon said there's nothing new under the sun, and The political genius of this man making all these changes, he had to study and think about some things from somewhere. And in Judges 18, verse 30, says, and the people of Dan set up the carved image for themselves, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, son of Moses, and his sons were priests to the tribe of the Danites, until the day of the captivity of the land. So there were seeds for this concept way back there.
Okay. Thank you. Oh, Ellie's got a comment.
Actually, there is a stronger reason why I picked that holiday. Because if you read in the book of Ezra, after they return and build the second temple, it's the first time that they start reading the Bible again, the Torah again, and they find out that there is a feast that they did not celebrate, and that's the Feast of Tabernacles. That means that they did not celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles almost from the days of the Judges till Ezra and Nehemiah. And so he's smart. He knows that it's a feast lost down south, and if he's going to bring it back, he's going to get a lot of credit. And that's why he's trying to reinstitute something he knows that the South forgot.
Okay. Interesting thought. Thank you. Thank you. That's just the sort of thing I was hoping for. Well, all this together, it's just very reminiscent of Daniel 7. Daniel 7:25, when we're looking at the little horn. What does it say? He would intend to change times and law. This man has done all of it. Jeroboam is in the same category with your Antiochus Epiphanes. He's in the same category with the Roman papacy. He has created his own religion for his own gain, and by so doing, oppresses the people of God. Janice had a comment up here.
The reason I said it was politically not good was because of the promise that was made to Jeroboam at the time that it was prophesied that he would become king. Let me read from 1 Kings chapter 11. However, as for you, I will take you, and you will rule over all that your heart desires. You will be king over Israel. If you do whatever I command you, and walk in my ways, and do what is right in my eyes, by keeping my statutes and commands, as David my servant did, I will be with you. I will build you a dynasty as enduring as the one I built for David, and will give Israel to you. So if, as in all of us, if he had just obeyed God's commands and stuck with him, he would have had the best kingdom you could imagine, and it would have been in his son's family forever.
Good point. Good point. That's an excellent point. Let's briefly touch on a man who would continue this trend for the nation of Israel. Jeroboam gets the nation off on terrible footing, and it never gets any better. How many kings did Israel have altogether? Anybody know? You've got a list in front of you if you want to count. 20. Is it 20 for Israel? Or is it 19 for Israel? 19 for Israel, 20 for Judah, which is very interesting, and we'll, Lord willing, touch on that in the next couple of days. You've got 39 kings there. 39. We've just got one more, and we're going to get to a nice number in the Bible, and I think Jesus is going to fit the bill there. None of those kings were righteous. Not one. In the south, you had men like Uzziah and Hezekiah and Josiah, but in the north, you had no good kings. And among the worst, there had never been any worse before him. Who is that?
Ahab.
1 Kings 16, Ahab gets him moving even further into debauchery. 1 Kings 16, starting in verse 30. Now Ahab, the son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. And it came to pass, as though it had been a trivial thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, he did all that he took his wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal. That's a red flag right there. Her dad's got Baal in his name. The daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and he went and served Baal and worshipped him. But he went more, did more than that. Then he set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal, which he had built in Samaria, and Ahab made a wooden image. Ahab did more to provoke the Lord God of Israel to anger than all the kings of Israel who were before him. Ahab continued in the sins of Jeroboam. He married Jezebel, this Phoenician. She's an idolater to the core. And then he allows her to lead him not only into the worship of Baal, but he goes one step further. Verse 32, he sets up an altar and builds a temple in Samaria, the capital city. And who's paying for that? It's the people. So what do we have here? This isn't like Ahab just starts worshiping Baal and the people of the country notice and they just start following suit. What's Ahab doing? He's saying, this is our new state religion. The government's paying for this. How many prophets is Jezebel feeding? 450 prophets of Baal, 400 prophets of Asherah at government expense. State-funded, state-sanctioned, and it could have no rivals. Jezebel in 1 Kings 18:4 is out prophesying, massacring the prophets of the Lord. And when Elijah had a level of success at Carmel, what does she do? I'm going to kill you too. Ahab takes it even further down. And the nation, I mean, a righteous person in the northern kingdom would have had a hard time. Think about it. Put yourself in that kingdom. You're wanting to do what's right. But the nation's been in idolatry since the very beginning. And now you've got a king who's in the dynasty of Omri, who may have had a level of success, and he's putting the state behind a religion. You'd have been hard-pressed to do the right thing in that situation. And it doesn't look like there were very many who did. Are there any closing comments? Okay. Well, tomorrow, Lord willing, we will very briefly finish up this religious heritage that Israel had. And then we will get into the text of Hosea and hopefully start moving at a pretty brisk pace.